Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, waging the Truth Jihad of the airwaves here. I bring on five or more guests every week, telling you all kinds of truths that you're rarely going to hear in the corporate-controlled mainstream. Well, we're back in the war on terror paradigm. I don't think we ever left it. Ever since 9/11, that's been the dominant paradigm. It's the social control tool of choice by today's international bankster-backed ruling elite. And the terror wave just keeps on rolling. The attacks keep on coming. The false flags keep on coming. Some of them we know are false flags. Others, we're not so sure. But we just had a wave of terror in three countries. This Friday, we had 63 people dead in attacks in Tunisia, Kuwait, and France. ISIS has been blamed. There are some serious questions about some of the information surrounding these events. And to talk about that, let's bring on Nick Kollerstrom. Nick Kollerstrom is the author of Terror on the Tube, Behind the Veil of 7-7. He is also well known for being a Holocaust free speech advocate, having been fired from University College of London for investigating the issue of what kind of gas chambers were used in World War II. So let's talk about these terror events. Nick, you just put up a blog post, Terror Hits Tunisia, covering some of this. Are we looking at more false flags?
Well, it's a bit early to say, Kevin. First of all, let me say it's wonderful to be back on your program again, and it's a wonderful job you're doing. I think between us, we want to try and evaluate, it probably is state terror. It probably is organised state terror. It's a bit early to say. But the question is, the huge question is, are these real deaths? They do look like real deaths, but I think we're both aware that since 2012, we've had state-fabricated terror done mainly with crisis actors, mainly with, you know, tomato ketchup blood and actors pretending to be dead and so on. And so we're wondering, are these real deaths? And I think we can benefit by comparing with other state-fabricated terror events. This is why we need to study the whole trajectory and arc of the 21st century false flag terror. For example, we've got another story here of a lone nut. Of a lone nut who apparently turns up in, what was it, a jet ski thing, lands onto this beach with all these British tourists and goes around shooting people and apparently can walk away. Then he can go into a hotel. Then apparently he's got a load of grenades on him and he's throwing grenades. People in the hotel are getting grenades blowing up. And then he can walk along the street and police are trying to shoot him, but they keep missing. So it goes on and on until finally he's killed. So we get another story then. The guy who is then named as the killer, I don't know if I can pronounce his name, but everyone around him is bewildered that he had no interest in politics. They had no interest in politics, didn't own any guns, never been radicalized. And Mr. Yacoubi.
Saifedean Yacoubi is the Saifedean name of this guy, Yacoubi. Supposedly.
Okay.
And you put up pictures on your blog. One of them shows him breakdancing, and the other has him sort of smiling in a white T-shirt next to a couple of guns, but he doesn't really fit the profile in either picture.
Yes. Notice the one and only picture that goes all around the world's media, this guy with a white T-shirt, and he's got, notice his Dracula teeth, long Dracula teeth, and his nose seems rather enlarged, and his hairdo has nothing whatever in common with the hairdo of the other guy, shorter curly hair. So what we always get in this in state-fabricated terror is identity theft. Always some fellow who's usually, as far as anyone knows, rather clueless or no interest in politics. Suddenly, that person is suddenly dead, and relatives are bewildered to have the story put about him. Oh, he's arrived in this jet ski, fiendishly killing people. And get this, of the 38 people killed, 30 were British. So So how did he go around picking out British people?
Well, you can tell they're the ones they have kind of these you know large front teeth, and they have these little Union Jack flags often tattooed on their arms. It's very easy to identify British people, Nick.
Oh right, yeah, I'm sure it is. Yeah, sort of obese, overweight look with.
That's right. That's right. They look like they've been eating bad food. Haven't been in the sun very much.
Well, one thing I'm just noticing, similar to the London bombing, very early reports said 30 British were killed, and now the evening paper tonight, some days later, is saying 15 British have been identified, and it is feared that the toll may rise to as much as 30. So,
sounds like after 9/11, when they first said they maybe 50,000 people killed, and look at the Palestinians celebrating, you know, and then it went way down.
All right. Yeah. Well, so the number of Brits killed seems rather prefixed on this. Then another very suspicious feature is where Britain's Prime Minister immediately says who's done it. Now, as we know, with 9/11, Bush and American media immediately started telling everyone that it was Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. And with the London bombing, Tony Blair, on the same day, he immediately told the British people that it was... you know, it was an Islamic crime. He knew before the police could possibly have got any clues that that was who had done it. And here we have, we're told that it's the Islamic State. Now, none of us are too sure what the Islamic State is, but...
ISIS, Israeli Secret Intelligence Service, right?
Israeli Secret Intelligence Service, yes. It's run by Simon Elliott, the well-known Mossad agent. The information for the Islamic State claiming responsibility for this attack and also naming this young man, that apparently was the evidence that nailed him, his identity, that is discovered, as it were, on this SITE thing, which is Rita Katz's intelligence group. Site.
So once again, ISIS is using Rita Katz of the Mossad front group, Site Intelligence Group, as their public relations agency.
Yeah, apparently they're the group that discovers these beheading videos and the Al-Qaeda bin Laden videos that then go into the official narrative. So if we're getting information from there, that makes it obviously very significant, very suspicious. The other thing, Kevin, is that we're coming up to the 10th anniversary of the London bombing, okay? That's in a week from now, and everybody's gearing up for it, making sure the British people are suitably scared and believe it and don't listen to people like me. So a week before, we get this terrible series of three events, Britain's foreign minister says it was, quote, the most significant terrorist attack on the British people since the London bombings. So that analogy is being made right away, okay?
And aren't they also talking about having to monitor this kind of, like, radicalism, nonviolent extremism, which is what we're doing here on the radio, by the way.
What we're doing here, absolutely, yeah. Cameron at the United Nations made this bold statement at the end of last year that the new enemy had been discerned, enemy within, of nonviolent extremists. And he gave two ways of detecting these people. One was that they thought Israel might have been involved in 9/11. And the other was that they believed that the London bombings were some sort of fixed up narrative.
So you were, of course, the number one, you know, you're perfect. You're the ultimate avatar of nonviolent extremism. So you went and turned yourself in, didn't you?
I turned myself in, yeah. I pointed out to the sergeant at Scotland Yard that this clearly applied to me.
But they wouldn't take you.
They wouldn't take me. Or they wouldn't even take my book. I said, my book points this out.
Here, this book is evidence against me, officer. Read it, please.
So
yeah, amazing.
They are clamping down, this is we're going to get a government white paper probably in a month from now that will enact new legislation, and Theresa May, our Home Secretary, is warning police to look out for any warning, is advising parents to look out for any sign of radicalisation amongst their children or their children's friends in any way, especially bedroom radicalisation. So if people are in their quietly in their own bedroom reading stuff. So
did they say that? Bedroom radicalisation?
Yeah. She's warning about bedroom radicalisation. So if you get police bursting into your bedroom, checking out if you're watching the wrong CDs.
So you can do anything you want in your living room, your drawing room, your basement, your attic. You can behead as many people as you want in those rooms, but not in the bedroom.
I wonder where they come up with it.
Who writes this stuff?
Well, this is so this is a very exciting and dramatic new terror threat. And assuming that there are real people involved, then obviously the question, who did it? Okay. Let's notice here, Kevin, we've got several perpetrators that turn up. I think all the initial reports of this Tunisia event have several people, either three or five, turn up on the beach. For example, and they come on some sort of boat or whatever, and one of them gets killed. And Russia Today reported this, three attackers in the Tunisian manner. And the Interior Ministry spokesman, Mohammed Ali Aru, told reporters this. Mm-hmm. So whoever you think did it, it's a group of several people. And then that again gets denied. So this is very much like the thing that happened in Oslo a few years back with Breivik, okay?
That's right.
There was a claim that he was a lone assassin and he single-handedly killed 50 people on this island, 50 youngsters. But the witnesses around there saw several people. So I think we're familiar that whenever we get a story of a lone nut accomplishing an extraordinary amount, this is an officially constructed narrative.
Yeah, we've had a number of other events like this too. The Batman shooting, the Sikh temple shooting, Sandy Hook. In all of these cases, there were reports of multiple shooters. And then they always grab the one patsy. So Breivik, of course, was set up to be the patsy. The professionals did a lot of the dirty work and then escaped scot-free. And something similar may have happened in Tunisia. This guy that they're putting up there could have been the patsy. And, you know, we know how they do this. You know, I noticed that you published a review of The Little Drummer Girl by John le Carré, which describes how the Mossad does this, how the Mossad creates, you know, fake terror, gets play, you know, hires actors to infiltrate terror groups and then run fake terror events and basically turn everything to their advantage. And so in these kinds of cases, you know, very likely, you know, you might have the patsy not really knowing what's going on, and then a couple of professionals do most of the killing, and the patsy is left to take the blame.
Yeah. The question is the patsy alive or dead at the end of it? If they're dead, like they are now, then there's obviously no danger of them saying the wrong thing or denying everything.
Is this guy dead? The Tunisia guy?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, he's very dead.
Well, that's
convenient. He was killed about noon.
Yeah. You know, you would think in these kinds of situations they would really want to catch them alive so they could interrogate them and find out who sent them.
Well, you would. Exactly. Yeah, that should be the absolute priority.
And I mean, there are ways to capture people without killing them. You know, they do it with animals, with animal tranquilizers and things like that. There's, you know, gas. There's all sorts of ways of, you know, there are these, you know, tasers. You can, I believe, you know.
Hang on. They would say that in Tunisia, the police didn't have all that stuff.
Probably not.
And this guy was walking on the street and he was strangely immune to various attempts to shoot him. Mm. And then some bricklayer, somebody at the top of the roof dropped some bricks onto his head and that knocked him out. And then they shot him, which again doesn't.
And then they shot him?
Yeah, yeah.
Why would they shoot him after he was knocked out?
That's the key question you just pointed out, Kevin. That's they would want him alive if possible. So why would they shoot him if he'd just been clobbered by bricks falling on his head?
So this sounds like a cartoon. You know, they're giving us more cartoons. I mean, the whole war on terror seems like it's almost based on cartoons. Some people say that's because they storyboard all of their events beforehand, just like Hollywood filmmakers do.
Yeah. But what we do know about this guy is that even 2 days before the effect, he showed no signs of radicalization, visiting a cafe and going for a walk and so on. And one video of him shows him breakdancing, okay?
Well, you have to watch out for breakdancers, though. I mean, they can get kind of out of control sometimes.
Oh, right. And there's a video of his home showing a totally impoverished-looking home with an empty fridge of a rundown student, which doesn't quite fit the image of somebody turning up on a ski jet with grenades and a Kalashnikov rifle and everything. So I think it's pretty obviously a stolen identity, you know, right, of a totally totally peaceable guy. I mean, when they try to find out stuff about him, they've got information such as he used to hair gel and wear the nicest of clothes and do breakdancing. He even used to go to competitions and things like that. He's well known. He didn't even have a beard. I've never seen him with anyone with a beard.
So all his friends and acquaintances are mystified.
Yeah. And this reminds me of the London bombings, where the, you know, all the people who knew the four alleged guys couldn't figure out any connection with their characters and what they're supposed to have done.
Mm-hmm. So same in the Casablanca bombings. You know, I actually spoke to the number one mainstream terror journalism in journalist in Morocco.
And he
investigated the London bombings, and of course in Morocco, you know, they're not going to come right out and challenge.
When was this Casablanca event?
The Casablanca event was pretty early on. I think it was like, was it 2002 or something? It was early on after 9/11.
All right.
And there were a couple of rounds of these things in Morocco, but that was the big one. And he said that he talked to all of the family and friends of the people that they blamed, who were completely mystified. These people showed no sign whatsoever of having the slightest interest in politics. Then on the day of the bombing, they just went about their business in a totally relaxed and normal way. Nobody could possibly, you know, it didn't make any sense that they had done it. And so you do hear this kind of thing over and over and over, and it really makes you wonder.
Yeah. Poor.
So the UK, of course, is really playing this up. It reminds me a little bit of the way the Australians were targeted with the Bali bombing. Once again, it was going after tourists, and they were going after Australia because they wanted to leverage Australia into the so-called war on terror. Yeah. So the Israelis used a miniature nuclear weapon, and they blamed it on a car bomb, but it created this giant crater in the road that only a nuclear weapon could have done.
And how do you know it was Israelis? I mean, you're probably right. I assume you are. But how do you know that?
Well, who was it? That Australian journalist.
Joe Veals.
Sorry?
Joe Veals.
Joe Veals. Right. Yeah. He reported that. And, we don't know for sure. We also have the Veterans Today crew who, of course, say that, and a whole lot of other things are Israeli mini nukes. But who else is going to be doing a mini nuke?
Okay, well, I agree with the comparison of Australia with Bali, being Australia being intimidated and made to support the war on terror.
Going after tourists in a fun place off in the third world, and hit the tourists from the nearby country, and then do the propaganda in the nearby country.
Yeah. If we ask what was a strategic purpose of this event, why was it done now? The immediate event could be to divert attention from the boats which were going to Gaza. There were three boats with various distinguished persons on board, weren't there, in an attempt to break the siege.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the occupants was a former president of Tunisia, Dr. Marzouki. Mm-hmm. He was the first president of Tunisia after the 2011 popular uprising. So maybe something had to be done about that. That was about the 28th, 29th of June. They set off on the 27th, the boats. So this event synchronized very well with it, and it knocked it. The Israelis have grabbed at least one of the boats, maybe all of them, and prevented them from going to Gaza. So this would have knocked that off the headlines.
That's a good point.
Would have been one thing, really. And I think you'll generally find that there's no mention in the mainstream media of this flotilla going out to Gaza, having been, stopped by Israel. Okay, now there's a larger possible larger strategic reason for this event in terms of the US wanting a base there. The US wanted their big base called AFRICOM in Tunisia, and the Tunisians, this was a couple of years back, had rejected it. They thought this would upset their those fundamental militias and attract attacks from the militias and might undermine the main source of income, which is tourism. So this terror event might enable them to be more sort of reasonable to the US request for a base to protect them against terrorism.
Very interesting. Yeah, so there's sort of a US-NATO link, and then there's the Israeli link of trying to wipe the Gaza flotilla out of the headlines. And that reminds me a bit of the Charlie Hebdo event and its timing, when it seemed to be punishing France for recognizing Palestine. Just 1 month before the Charlie Hebdo event, France's parliament voted to recognize Palestine. And then, of course, at the same time, Hollande was bucking NATO and trying to make peace with Russia, among other things.
Yeah, that's right. So that sort of taught them a lesson, didn't it?
Right. So I think in many of these cases, probably including 9/11, what we have is a kind of Gladio B operation, as Sibel Edmonds called it, which is referring to the Operation Gladio, the stay-behind armies during the Cold War that staged most of the so-called left-wing terror during the Cold War. And that apparatus, which is still in existence, it's never been really punished. I mean, the European Parliament has exposed it, but they never did anything about it. They never punished the people who murdered the people in the Bologna train station bombing and the Brabant massacre and all these other massacres, killed Aldo Moro and so on and so forth. They never punished them. So those people are still around. Those networks still exist. Yeah. And the networks, I think, are now
probably with top NATO jobs.
Right. And so, but the Israelis, I think, have connected with, you know, what is, you know, the current incarnation of Operation Gladio, what Sibel Edmonds calls Gladio B. And so I think the Israelis are working with Gladio B on this wave of terror.
Could you tell us a bit more about this? Sibel Edmonds talking about Gladio B.
Yeah. Well, you can, of course, just drop that into a search engine and find out more about it. But she has said that when she was working as FBI translator, she found all this incriminating stuff and basically discovered that there is this still, what's called Gladio B, the current incarnation of Gladio, which is involved in running so-called Islamic terror. And she saw documents showing the involvement of people like Richard Perle and other neoconservatives who were creating these front groups called things like the American Turkish Council and the American Azerbaijan Council. And these were front groups that were actually running drugs through Turkey and using that drug money to pay for terrorism, primarily false flag terrorism that would be blamed on Muslims. Or, you could get actual people who are nominally Muslims or, who have Muslim names to be the patsies or the low-level soldiers in these kinds of situations. You can get them to run the drugs for you. You get them to do the attacks. So Gladio B is basically the new version of Gladio, but it seems like there's a lot more of an Israeli connection now. Israel was not that visible in the original Operation Gladio, and they're certainly very prominent now in this wave of false flag Islamic terror.
Yeah. You always assume they're going to be present, don't you?
Right. And of course, Rita Katz is stepping forward and, claiming credit for all these things. I mean, when Rita Katz says ISIS claimed credit, what it really means is that Rita Katz and the Mossad have claimed credit.
Oh, dear. Okay, I'd like to mention one other factor in here, a bit difficult talking about radio show, of fabricated fake photos that various people have noticed in this Tunisia attack. Okay, and Mao said we had this very conspicuously a couple of years back, what was called the Drummondly Rigby event in London that gave a terrific boost to anti-Islamic fervor.
Right, that was a beheading, or was that a real beheading?
Yeah, it's supposed to be a beheading. Mm-hmm. And the different photos sequences had obviously been made at different times and strung together. Mm-hmm. You could see the different shadows, and in one the shops were open, the other shops were closed.
How unprofessional.
We've got a continuity error.
Yeah, it's a B-grade movie sometimes they have those.
Yeah, right. So we've got this in the sequences shown on the news. The gunman is strolling along the beach. And the people are not running for their lives, and many are not looking at him at all. He's not cast in shadow, and the day looks quite dull. But in other pictures, the sunlight is intense and the shadows are very sharp. So those things are not all done on the same day, okay? And then there's a bland colouring and lack of detail in the pictures of the terrorist, and also when the gunman is running along the beach. Then another picture, the gunman is wandering aimlessly along a brilliantly lit street, looking for somewhere to pray and get shot or whatever he's doing, and his shadow is very intense. And there's people say there's ghosting around him that you don't see in other pictures, and the shadow cast by him and the wall are inconsistent with the same sun angle. So it looks very much like a screenshot taken several days earlier and put together.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that's odd, isn't it? That's also reminiscent a little bit of Charlie Hebdo, where we had the fake shooting of the police officer on the sidewalk that got exposed.
Yeah, that was obviously
showing his play acting. And you mentioned earlier that in many of these events, including the Boston bombing, Sandy Hook, and possibly others, it appears that there are crisis actors being used, that not as many people are being killed as we're told. Maybe nobody's being killed. And that's certainly the case of that police officer who's not being shot point blank in the head with an assault rifle on the sidewalk in front of Charlie Hebdo.
It certainly is, yeah. But I would say nobody died at all at Charlie Hebdo.
So what do you think happened to those Charlie Hebdo cartoonists?
Well, I mean, in the Charlie Hebdo office, did you see any dead bodies? No. Did you see any blood? No. Did you see any death certificates? No. Did you see any coroner's inquests? No. I mean, those people in the Charlie Hebdo office, they're now somewhere in South America with very big paychecks, and the people who disappear, look at, they're mostly high-level Freemasons and Zionists, you know, and they've had the fun and excitement of an identity change, and they're very well paid for it. Now, the other deaths that happened was in some supermarket. If you remember, there's a Jewish supermarket.
Yeah, the kosher deli.
Kosher supermarket.
Yeah.
And this guy allegedly went in and started shooting. And there's four supposed deaths, and that was the pretext for the whole Israeli involvement, and you know, Netanyahu turning up and everything. And we, by the way, got big yellow Jewish security cars roaming around the streets of London, and apparently they were roaming. They were all around France, protecting synagogues from alleged anti-Semitism.
These are private security outfits?
Yes, it's some sort of private security outfit that the British police aren't entirely happy with. But anyway, the point I'm making is that those four alleged deaths, they were then said to be, quote, buried in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. Now, that tells you there's no real deaths, okay?
Yeah, you know, that's exactly what they did with the Mohammed Mura events, which happened a couple of years before Charlie Hebdo, but they were clearly exactly on the same model, where there was a shooting of some French soldiers, and the witnesses said that the shooter had blue eyes and tattoos, like spider tattoos, of the type that neo-Nazis have. Then there was a shooting a day or two later in a Jewish school, and this was blamed on Mohammed Mera, an Arab. And the bodies of the people killed in the Jewish school were never verified. There were no inquests, no autopsies. They just were instantly flown to Jerusalem to be buried as heroes in Israel, we were told. So in the book, We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, we have Dr. Laurent Guyenot questioning whether anybody actually got shot in that school. And so the same thing might have happened in the kosher deli.
Oh, right. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I would say nobody died in the entire Charlie Hebdo saga. It was totally just actors.
Well, if we could get some hard evidence for that, we should. You know, I would love to write something. If you want to write something up, you know, just making the best possible argument for that.
All right.
I would
be
happy to publish that.
Is that not generally stated in your book?
Yeah, in the book, you know, we talk about the fake sidewalk shooting, of course, but don't really go into the issue of whether or not there might have been, you know, Christ people not really being killed, because we just don't have any direct evidence either way on that question. But right. It's certainly if they're having the so-called terrorists who've just come out of the Charlie Hebdo offices shoot blanks and are just play acting and pretending to shoot a police officer on the street, then that leads you to wonder whether they were really shooting when they were in the Charlie Hebdo offices.
Well, exactly. That the reason you needed to have that sequence of shooting in the street was to give you people the idea of people being shot, because there's no evidence of it in the Charlie Hebdo office. You just had a load of stuff disappear, and then after they disappeared, get this, they bring out their best-selling ever issue, sells millions, scoffing at the profit. The defunct Charlie Hebdo office somehow managed to bring out a new edition, isn't it?
Sells
by the million. Must have made God knows how many million euros.
Yeah. Whoever was propping up Charlie Hebdo when it was losing money for all those years made it all back overnight.
Yeah. This totally made back all the money they were losing. The view I would take, what I think is important to come out of Sandy Hook, of the Charlie Hebdo event, is that European kind of intellectuals need to learn from each other, because there's been state-fabricated terror in various major European countries now, and by themselves, they're all given this fake narrative, you know. And I think if people from, you know, Madrid and Paris and London could get together, maybe Amsterdam about the shoot down of the plane, and obviously Italy had the very first, Italy did fully deconstruct the Gladio events in its parliament. I just wonder if there's any hope of getting some sort of European movement, or I think journalists would realize they've got a story then if you had that.
Well, that would be a great event if you could have a sort of some kind of a conference, or, you know, European Parliament on, you know, Gladio and false flag terror or something like that. If you could have an event, the more official, the better, and bring all that together. That would be great. Your sound is starting to fade in and out. So, you know, I'm going to call you back and try and reestablish a good connection. So we're going to take an involuntary midpoint break. This is Kevin Barrett. You're listening to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm interviewing Dr. Nick Kullerstrom, author of Terror on the Tube, and that's his blog, terrorontheTube.co.uk. We'll be right back. Kevin Barrett, you're listening to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm talking with Nick Kullerstrom. He is a PhD in history of science with a specialist in chemistry. He was summarily fired from University College London for publishing an article about the issue of what kind of gas chambers were used in World War II. Were they human execution gas chambers, or were they used for delousing clothing? Well, everybody admits there were gas chambers used for delousing clothing that used Zyklon B. The question is whether similar larger chambers were also used for humans. Nick's evidence pointed towards the negative, and they fired him and wouldn't give him a reason. So whatever you may think about that particular issue, this is a horrific affront to free speech, and Nick has been plowing ahead, calling it the way he sees it ever since. Well, Nick, we were just talking about the issue of crisis actors and the fake terror events where they tell us that these huge bloody massacres have occurred. And in fact, in some cases, it appears that maybe they didn't even happen. We just got all these things on the same day. And we just were talking a lot about Tunisia, which was the big one. But the same day, this was just last Friday, the 26th of June, there were also attacks in Kuwait and France, and I believe there was a actual beheading in France. This is the signature. You know, whenever the Israelis want to really make Muslims look bad, they try to have, you know, Rita Katz of the Mossad spinoff Site Intelligence Group take credit for a beheading video on behalf of the so-called Islamic State.
But tell me, Kevin, is there any Muslims in Europe that object to this or try to give an alternative narrative? Because what we find whenever we try to have some truth meeting is that Muslims never come, and the nearest we've got to a radical Muslim in this country is Nafiz Ahmed. And as you know, he sort of talks about Al-Qaeda, but he will never really deny that Muslims did it, will he? I'm not criticizing him.
Well, he actually said at the conference in Washington, D.C. in July of 2005, which was right, we had that conference almost at the same time as the London bombings 10 years ago.
All right, yeah.
And he was there. That's the only time I've met him. And he said, quote, you know, if I told you what I really think happened, you know, they'd say I was crazy.
All right. Yeah.
So
yeah.
He's
a good man.
He's just really careful about how he expresses.
Yeah, he's a good man, but he won't deconstruct. What we desperately need is some Muslim who will talk about the real identity of these people. Whenever you get state fabricated terror, there is identity theft, and some Muslim gets totally demonized, and all his relatives and people in Yemen are baffled by this story that's been suddenly put onto them. And we need Muslims who will reconstruct and rescue the real identity of who these people really were.
I don't know if Muslims have any particular advantage over anybody else in terms of doing that kind of investigation. Because, you know, whenever they do this kind of identity theft, they're usually doing it around people that they have some kind of hold on. Like, for instance, with the 9/11 alleged hijackers, 15 of the 19 were the Saudis who were brought over to the US and CIA snitch visas. But apparently there may have been second and third identities, people, you know, using those identities, setting up the alleged hijackers. We know that for a fact with Ziad Jarrah. He was the Lebanese alleged 9/11 hijacker. And his whole family works for Mossad, and he was working for Mossad too. But for whatever reason, there were at least two other people who were using his ID. So we have identity cards of Ziad Jarrah showing three different people, and now you say, well, you know, could Muslims figure this out better than anybody else? I don't know. I mean, Jay Kolar isn't a Muslim. He wrote the article on what we now know about the alleged 9/11 hijackers, published in Zaremka's 9/11 compilation. And what we need is good investigators, especially people with access to the real investigative agencies, the military, the spy agencies, and the police agencies. And one of the reasons I work with veterans today is you know, they're at least trying to develop some of those kinds of connections. But it's tough because when, you know, these ultra black covert operations where they just don't want, you know, they're hidden behind seven different veils, kind of, and it's very hard to penetrate them. You know, after 9/11, Muhammad Atta's father came out in public and said, my son called me the day after 9/11, and he works for Mossad. So,
did he?
You know,
I never heard him say that.
Yeah. And he said, if you want to know who did 9/11, if you want to know what happened to my son, please ask the Mossad.
Wow, I don't remember that. Wow,
well,
that
the media didn't make a huge hoopla over it, that's for sure.
Wow, that really changes things.
Yeah, and other relatives of the alleged hijackers demanded DNA evidence. They said, we'll be happy to supply, you know, family DNA evidence. We want to see whether any of our relatives or these guys you're accusing were really on the plane. And the U.S. government refused. So to this date, the U.S. government claims to have DNA evidence of the remains of the alleged passengers on these alleged flights on 9/11, but it has no DNA from any of the alleged hijackers.
They weren't on the planes, were they?
Well, of course not. Yeah, even the flight list, the flight manifest that they released to the media don't have any of those Muslims or any other Muslim names on any of those manifests. And so you know, the people whose identities have been stolen and who've been victimized by this, such as the relatives of these 9/11 hijackers, the relatives of other patsies, I think a lot of them get intimidated. In France, the relatives of Mohamed Merah were put into solitary confinement. They were arrested for no reason except to keep them silent, put into solitary confinement and maltreated. And finally, apparently, some kind of, you know, understanding with them was reached. And they were released, and they won't talk to anybody.
Right. Well, in the case of Charlie Hebdo, the one real death that is totally documented is this police superintendent who was preparing a report and talking to all the families of the victims of Charlie Hebdo. And he was just drawing up that report. and then he suddenly felt an urge to pick up a gun and shoot himself in the head.
Right. Helric Fredoux, yeah, he's the police officer who was, he was looking into the relationship between Jeanette Bougrabe and Charb, the editor of Charlie Hebdo. And Jeanette Bougrabe is a Mossad-linked, you know, Sarkozy-Netanyahu apparatchik, who's had fairly high positions in the French government. And so she surfaced right after this Charlie Hebdo thing, weeping and saying, oh, you know, Charb was my, he was my my significant other, and I, oh, you know, and crying and stuff. And all of Charb's relatives said, no, this he didn't have any relationship with Jeanette Bougrabe. She's making it all up. And they wouldn't even let her go to the funeral. They barred her from the funeral. But she's been going all over the world doing speaking events, making money, publishing a book, claiming that she was the boyfriend of Charb, the editor of Charlie Hebdo. So there's something weird going on here. Now, it turns out that Helric Fredoux, the police officer who was suicided on the night of the Charlie Hebdo attack, he was staying up late investigating the family background of Charb and apparently Jeanette Bougrabe. And he was talking, he had his men out interrogating Jeanette Bougrabe's parents. And he learned something that made him very excited. He called home and said he wasn't coming home. He was going to be up all night. He had a hot lead. And the next thing you know, he turns up with a bullet in the head.
Yeah. And then his widow turned up and said she didn't believe it. And why weren't the police telling her anything?
Right. And now Jeanette Bougrabe is really getting into hot water, because not only have all of the relatives of Charb said that she had nothing to do with him, she was not his girlfriend, she's lying, but now they're also saying, and other people are charging, that she got the keys to Charb's apartment after Charb was supposedly shot and ransacked it and just took everything out. Dépouillé was the French word they used, which kind of means ransacked or you know, just went over it with a fine-tooth comb and removed lots of stuff. So they said she got a hold of the keys under false pretenses and ransacked his apartment afterwards, perhaps removing incriminating evidence. And the hypothesis is that as a Mossad, you know, Netanyahu apparatchik, Jeanette Bougrabe would have been creating a fake relationship with Charb in order to create a situation where she could easily funnel money to Charlie Hebdo. She was probably the bag woman taking the money that kept Charlie Hebdo alive, because it was losing huge amounts of money for years. Nobody was reading it. Yet somebody was propping it up.
It's kind of obscene and nauseating magazine.
Right. Well, it was you know, moderately popular, actually, you know, made enough money to support itself back in the 1970s. But in the last decade, it became just very, very untrendy. Nobody cared about it. And then suddenly, a couple of years ago, it started, you know, going on this anti-Islam crusade, publishing attacks on Islam. And that wasn't particularly popular either. They didn't sell very many copies. They were, you know, they should have been out of business a decade ago. But somebody was funneling the money. And the hypothesis is that it was going through Jeanette Bougrabe, and maybe they had a joint bank account with Charb, and they had what the intelligence community calls a legend, which is a very carefully developed sort of fake background with a story associated with it, that she and Charb were an item, and then they could use that to explain why they would have a fake bank account, or rather a shared bank account.
Yeah, well, it all sounds very likely. Yeah. I mean, I'm surprised that the French people believe this story, actually. It's such obviously done with actors. Anyway, may I ask Kevin how your book is selling? It's quite a success, I gather.
It's doing pretty well. It sells very, very well at my talks. The talks have been outstanding successes. I'm actually averaging pretty much everybody who comes to my talk buys a book. So that's been very gratifying. And I will be going on a book tour. When's that? About a couple of weeks now. It's a week, 2.5 weeks from now.
Can't be sold in France at all, can it?
Sure. Well, I hope so. You know, but I just got some alarming news. I'm going to be doing a talk at the bookstore here in Wisconsin. And the bookstore owner said that when she was traveling, staying at a hotel, I think in Phoenix, she tried to get to Amazon to grab some stuff to use for publicity for my talk. And it was blocked. It said, something like unacceptable content. And so they were blocking the Amazon site for the book.
Well, there.
And I wonder how many other places it's blocked.
Yeah, it is up on Amazon, isn't it?
Yeah. So maybe people, if you ever have access to these kinds of shared computers, libraries and hotels and restaurants and things like that, check and make sure that you can get to the We Are Not Charlie Hebdo blogspot site and make sure that it's up on Amazon. And if it isn't, you know, we've got a serious problem and somebody could get sued for that, because you know, if you're selling a book and it gets flagged as dangerous content and the website gets blocked, hurting sales, you know, that's that creates some economic damages, and it's an affront to the First Amendment as well. So I hope that my listeners will do that. If you're at a library or at some other kind of shared internet site, just make sure you can get to the We Are Not Charlie Hebdo site, both on Amazon and then also wearenotcharliehebdo.blogspot.com. And if it's blocked, please email me by way of the website truthjihad.com and let me know.
So perhaps sometime you'll do a promotion over here, Kevin. Come over to London.
I would be happy to come to London, although I think that maybe David Cameron would have me blocked as a nonviolent extremist, because, you know, I am nonviolent, David. I admit it. So sue me. So shoot me, you know.
Well, it'll be, we're waiting to see what form this legislation will take. But broadly speaking, Kevin, up till now, there's been a clear distinction between law-abiding citizens and criminals. You knew which one you were, you know. I mean, we crime used to be defined as a deed, as something that you did that was bad. And then, with Tony Blair's government, we got a load of adjutorial legislation which allowed police to arrest you because of something you might be intending to do, right? So a kind of thought crime of what they think your intentions are. And that obviously was to get Muslims, any Muslims reading the wrong literature sort of thing, or any bookshop selling truth jihad book, for example, might be clubbed under that act. But now we're getting this new legislation that Theresa May is going to bring in that will criminalise this idea of non-violent extremism, that if you're just a bedroom getting radicalised in your bedroom, that this is something the police might have to stop. And obviously, this is all, the terms here are totally undefinable, aren't they? You can't possibly prove your innocence. I don't see how anyone can prove their innocence any more than anyone can prove your guilt. It's just a miasma of vagueness that is perhaps inherent in the idea of a war on terror, whereby basically everybody feels rather scared. But that seems to be the general aim.
Yeah, it does seem like it. It's a strategy of tension thing, just like during Operation Gladio in the Cold War, they said that it was a strategy of tension to kind of polarize things. What they didn't like was that the left wing was becoming too mainstream friendly, and they were making alliances across the political spectrum. And like Aldo Moro, the prime minister in Italy, was a Christian Democrat, I believe, but he was reaching out to the left, and he was going to have a coalition government involving the left. And the Operation Gladio NATO
involving
people,
the communists. It was the communists.
Yeah, they didn't want the communists being brought into the government. They didn't.
That was what Henry Kissinger said. It couldn't be tolerated, wasn't it?
Right.
The country should go communist of its own accord.
Right. So what they had to do was to demonize the left, and so they went out and murdered people and blamed it on the left, and that's exactly what's happening now with Islam. I think what they're really afraid of is the potential for a kind of Islamic renaissance or rebirth, which we saw with the Iranian Revolution of 1979, which gave birth to the one functioning democratic republic in the Islamic world. Malaysia is close, but Iran is definitely the most democratic country in the Islamic world. But it's also an Islamic country. Islamic norms, dress codes, things like that are part of the social structure. And it's also a revolutionary Islamic country in the sense that it officially identifies with the oppressed people all over the world. Now, this is kind of the worst nightmare of the banksters behind the big, you know, Western power structure. And Zionism, those people really do not want to see the world's 1.5 billion Muslims suddenly getting mobilized to go out and work for and fight with the oppressed people of the world. They don't want to see them having Islamic revolutions and throwing the corporate imperialists and the Zionists out of these Islamic countries. So they've had this huge operation containment against Iran ever since the revolution. First, they sent their boy Saddam to massacre a million Iranians with chemical weapons and so on, with the aggressive Iraqi war against Iran. Saddam was sent by the West on that errand, and they gave him the chemical weapons he used to slaughter huge numbers of Iranians. And we never hear about that. All we ever heard about was, oh, Saddam, he gassed his own people. He gassed a handful of Kurds in his country, and he gassed a huge number of Iranians, but nobody cares about that because we are the ones who really did that. We're the ones. We the West, gassed those Iranians. But they'll never tell you that in the mainstream media. So anyway, I think this is all a big containment operation against the Islamic Renaissance that began, or the awakening, some people call it, began with the Islamic Revolution in Iran. And they're doing everything they can to keep it under control, and they're doing a strategy of tension, polarization, by creating these ultra-extreme lunatic groups like ISIS. They, of course, very much created and encouraged Al-Qaeda, or Al-CIA, as some people call it. Now they're doing it even more ridiculously with ISIS. And all of this is to make Islam look bad, to create a fight between Islam and the rest of the world. And unfortunately, it's working to a certain extent so far, and they've certainly stirred up a lot of strife between Sunni and Shia Muslims. They've screwed up Iran's relations with its neighbors through this strategy of tension, this false flag wave of terror. And it's sad to see people falling for it. And you mentioned, Nick, that you saw recently over at Infowars.com, Paul Joseph Watson videotaped himself doing this Islamophobic rant. Just talking about these false flag events and blaming them on Muslims. It looks like InfoWars is going to merge with Fox News now, doesn't it?
Well, I was rather shocked and astonished by this. I mean, some people are uneasy about Muslims because they come in and, you know, so the breed, and are they taking over European countries just by numbers? That is one thing people are uneasy about. But I mean, I wouldn't have thought there was a case for someone on Prison Planet to, as it were, believe that they're doing this. I'm very shocked that as if they've just lost their marbles. In a way, you could say it's due to coming out with opinions too quickly. When this state-fabricated terror happens, basically, you need to keep quiet for a bit. I mean, we are having a tentative discussion here, but the truth will not come out for several weeks, and there is a case for waiting a bit until the official story blows over and the truth starts to come out. And I wonder if Paul Joseph Watson sort of somehow failed to do that. He's obviously swallowed the mainstream media doctrine of who to hate, which is what they tell you.
And that's really strange, because InfoWars has traditionally been a 9/11 truth website. You know, it's run by Alex Jones, the most prominent voice of 9/11 truth. And of course, that may not be such a good thing in certain respects. But InfoWars has always questioned this false flag terror. And since, you know, 9/11 truth is the defining issue of our time, and Paul Joseph Watson supposedly gets that, you would think he would notice that the whole point of 9/11 was to demonize Islam, and that this wave of so-called Islamic terror has been manufactured. It's fabricated. I mean, some of it is 100% fabricated. Some of it, well, if you stir people up and give them guns and point them in the right direction, that's another way of fabricating it. So it's essentially all fabricated. If the West was not consciously creating this kind of insane terror, it would never have happened. Sure, Muslims and Christians and Palestinian atheists would be perhaps bombing Israelis. And why not? I mean, they're being genocided. Of course they're going to bomb the Israelis. That kind of so-called terror, that's not terror. Likewise, if the people of Iraq resist American occupation with roadside bombs, IEDs, and do the same thing in Afghanistan, that's not terror. That's patriotism. You know, if my country was occupied, I would be doing the same thing to get rid of the occupiers. So what they've done is they're trying to demonize the legitimate Islamic struggles, which are mostly nonviolent struggles for, let's say, Muslim empowerment, for getting the word out about what Islam is really about, these kinds of things, and forming viable Islamic societies in today's world. They don't want that to happen. So they're fabricating this so-called terror threat and smearing all Muslims, anybody, and especially Muslims who resist the empire in any way. And so, mm-hmm. like, you know, if I were to support Hamas and Hezbollah, which I do, by the way, but that's going to be very unpopular now because everybody's been conditioned with the, you know, the Zionists blowing up the World Trade Center, the Zionists blowing up the trains and buses in London, the Zionists slaughtering people in Mumbai, the Zionists blowing up trains in Madrid, the Zionists killing people or maybe pretending to kill people in Paris, and on and on and on. So all that stuff, it conditions their responses. And so when I try to defend Hamas and Hezbollah, which are fighting a just struggle against the Israelis, that's going to be equated with all this lunacy that's actually being done by the Zionists themselves. And it makes it much harder to get resistance going.
We do tend to assume that it's Israel Mossad behind this. I must say, in my study of state fabricated terror, I've only come across one that didn't ostensibly have any such connection. That was the Drummer Lee Rigby story.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that. The Drummer Lee Rigby was the British soldier supposedly beheaded by some lunatic Muslim.
What happened there? What I can say is that the whole theatre, street theatre, of what happened that day, nobody died. They just had some sort of rubber dummy, which was supposed to be him, and he was thrown into the middle of the road, and they sort of didn't put the blood in the right place at all. And you had obviously actors hanging around, and they had Photoshop blood on their hands, and none of it looked remotely plausible. And the shoot police shot somebody about 6 times at close range, and I missed. So there's all a lot of bad actors hanging around. And as with Charlie Hebdo, the street was totally cleared of traffic a couple of hours before the event.
So it's like a Hollywood movie shoot.
Yeah, no normal traffic at all. A question is, did Drummer Lee Rigby really exist? And I think the jury's still out on that one. But if he did exist, then he probably died just before the event. But that had an enormous effect all over the world. Just as this traditional British-looking drummer and this really scruffy-looking, unpleasant guy who apparently killed him.
So cartoonish.
Yeah, and everyone who knew this alleged killer guy was totally baffled. They said, well, you know, he's a nice guy. We never found anything violent about him, you know. But he was somewhat conditioned by British intelligence. They had got a hold of him in some degree.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't find any evidence of Israeli involvement in that one?
No, that was the one where it didn't seem to turn up. It didn't seem to be present. But normally there's always some sort of signature that you find in these events.
Well, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. With 7/7, remember, was it Netanyahu or was it
Netanyahu?
Yeah, Netanyahu was in London,
and he had foreknowledge.
Yeah, he was given foreknowledge. Yeah,
yeah.
Of course, that doesn't necessarily prove he did it, but again, I think that.
Well, as well as that, there was also the article in the Jerusalem Post, if you remember, that same day, written by Halevi, called "Rules for Waging a Third World War," and it had quite obviously been written beforehand. It had quite obviously been written some time beforehand.
Right.
It hadn't just been prepared in 2 hours.
Right.
And it knew that article knew far too much about what had just happened, far too quickly.
And
so I think that's a very key bit of evidence that is foreknowledge. And there's no one else except Mossad that has this foreknowledge. Same as with 9/11. You know, the Israeli nationals get this information exactly when it's going to happen, and no one else seems to have it. That Adigo text messaging firm that got the warning of when exactly the 9/11 event was going to happen that morning. That's just a general theme, and I guess that hasn't yet turned up in this Tunisia event, has it? We don't as yet have evidence. I mean, there is one report on the event which argues that Israeli Mossad has had previous involvement in Tunisia events, which I haven't been into it, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, we'll have to wait and see on that one, I guess. It looks like we're just about at the end of the show, Nick. It's been great. Very interesting. Right here on the 10th anniversary of the London bombings of 7/7/2005, suddenly a huge number of British tourists supposedly slaughtered on the beach in Tunisia. along with two other iconic events in France and Kuwait, ISIS being blamed, Site Intelligence Group, the PR agency of ISIS, taking credit for the acts on behalf of the Israeli Mossad. We're living in a very interesting world, and I appreciate your contributions, Nick Kullerstrom, to helping elucidate what's really going on. So keep up the good work. And your website is terroronthetube.co.uk.
Yes, well, perhaps we'll come back when a bit more info has come out about this event, Kevin. Another month or so, and see how things have developed.
Okay, sounds good. terroronthetube.co.uk. I'm Kevin Barrett. My website is truthjihad.com. Back next time. Take care, Nick. Talk later.
The moon is
the same moon above you, aglow with its cool evening light, but shining at night in Tunisia, never does it shine so bright. The stars are aglow.